From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we check up on the Republican Voter Engagement Office in the city of Detroit. Are they winning anyone over to the GOP?
It's kind of interesting that there aren't more black Republicans in Detroit or in Metro Detroit when so many different ideals are sort of crossing paths.
We look at GOP Congressman Kerry Benevolio's write-in campaign for the 11th District. Could he siphon enough votes away from Dave Trott to send a Democrat to Washington? Benevolio says he's fine with that.
It's not the sort of thing you usually hear a Republican saying, but Congressman Benevolio is not your run-of-the-mill Republican.
And we meet the South African author of Broken Monsters, a suspense and horror story set in Detroit.
Detroit is like my hometown, Johannesburg, a city which is much maligned.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Detroit's Republican headquarters. Well, maybe it isn't the loneliest campaign office in Michigan, but that doesn't make the job any easier.
Bradley's work is admirable, but I think people just see the word Republican and are just turned off by it immediately.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we'll check in on the GOP Voter Engagement Office in Detroit. And we'll meet the South African author of Broken Monsters, a suspense and horror story set in the D.
You know, in South Africa, we like to think that we do crime and corruption and segregation the best, but you guys do a pretty good job out there.
But first, to Michigan's 11th Congressional District, a Republican congressman who was thumped in the August primary decided to mount in a write-in campaign, even though it could drain off enough votes to send the Democratic candidate to Washington. Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler is here to sort this all out for us. Hey, Todd.
Good to talk to you.
Tell us a little about the 11th. Just where is it geographically and politically?
Sure. The Michigan 11th sits in western Wayne County and southeastern Oakland County. It used to be more of a Wayne County district centered around Livonia back when Thad McCotter used to represent it. But he ran into a couple of tight elections, and so the Republican legislature in Lansing moved it. I mean, they made it more of a Republican district, moved it more into Oakland County. It's considered pretty solid Republican territory there.
Although it did give the Senate race 2 years ago to Democrat Debbie Stabenow, but it's basically in the GOP corner.
That's right. It's thought up to be a sort of a Republican plus four, I mean, which is a little over the average. Should be pretty safe, but you're right. I mean, there have been Democrats who have won there before. You're absolutely right that that Senator Stabenow won there, and in the previous district, Barack Obama won there in 2008.
So remind us how Kerry Benevolio became the accidental congressman for the 11th.
He really doesn't like to be called that. But yeah, I mean, it did happen by accident. He had filed to run against McCotter, who used to be there. And when Congressman McCotter ran into problems with his campaign submitting false and fraudulent re-election petition signatures, and McCotter got out of the race, Benevolio was the only Republican left. There were a lot of mainstream Republican types in Oakland County, particularly, who tried to get somebody to run against him. And they did put up a write-in candidate in 2012. But write-in candidates are have a hard time winning, as Congressman Benevolio is going to find out. And Benevolio, you know, won and became, like you said, the accidental congressman.
And for the rest of Michigan who perhaps wasn't paying, you know, didn't have as close a sense of the 11th district, kind of remind us just who Kerry Benevolio is, what his background is, and how effective he's been in his couple of years in Congress.
Sure. Congressman Benevolio is more of a populist-type politician, really came out of nowhere, sort of rode the Tea Party wave. He's a former educator. He's a National Guardsman. You know, he famously, you know, had a ranch where he had some reindeer and would dress up as Santa Claus. People have made a lot of that. I mean, it's colorful. You know, in Congress, Congressman Benevolio has been fine. He hasn't, you know, done anything that's really made people jump up and down and say, what's this guy up to? You know, he hasn't been a terribly close ally of leadership. That's hurt him, I think, in some ways. But no, he hasn't, you know, come here and done anything terrible or that. But I think there are people, particularly those in Oakland County, who could see Mr. Trott, who has deep ties to local politics, as being a potentially more effective congressman, someone who could be a leader in the state delegation. And frankly, Congressman Benevolio is not seen like that.
So it was clear when primary time rolled around this year, the party put its support and its money towards attorney Dave Trott. Talk more about what kind of candidate he is and why they felt he was the one to put up in this election.
Well, I mean, Mr. Trott's got his own vulnerabilities. As you well know, he's made a lot of money with his firm being active in foreclosures around Michigan. But from a positive standpoint, you know, Mr. Trott is very well spoken. He's got deep connections in Republican circles in Michigan and in specifically in Oakland County. You know, he played a somewhat of a role in the Mitt Romney campaign in 2012. He's sharp. He speaks well. You know, he sort of clicks off all the boxes. He's the sort of person that, you know, if he wins this race, as we expect him to, you know, you might see bigger things from him down the road.
And what about Bobby McKenzie, the Democratic candidate? Tell us a little about him.
Sure. Mitch McKenzie is a former, you know, State Department employee. He's done some national security work, you know, around the world. So he's a political newcomer. I mean, this is really his first time around. And frankly, if somebody else had gotten in that race, you know, he might not be the candidate. This is a good testing ground for him. He's running a very aggressive campaign right now. I don't think he's got the money to win, particularly in a district that's as Republican as that one. But he's at least, you know, putting up a good fight.
But then speaking of putting up a good fight, Kerry Benevolio recently made it public that he said, bowing to popular pressure, he's going to mount a write-in campaign, right?
Yeah, that's what he says. Yeah, he doesn't have much money. He spent most of it on the primary, in which he got just trounced by Trot. And he says that a lot of people have contacted him asking, or basically saying, they're not going to vote if they can't vote for him because they don't want to vote for Trot. And so Benevolio says he's running so that he can give people somebody to vote for on the ballot, and they can turn out for other Republican candidates. At first, he said he didn't think it would change the outcome of the election. But last week, he told me that he thinks the Democrats are going to win because of him entering the race. Frankly, that's a long shot. But, you know, with an incumbent congressman getting in, you never know what might happen. I think that Mr. Trott's got more than enough money to get his message out there, though, between now and Election Day.
Benevolio told you it wasn't sour grapes, didn't he?
Yes. He likes to say that it's not sour grapes, but then goes on to sort of sound like it's sour grapes. And he talks a lot about being betrayed. And his argument is that as someone who went to Congress and, you know, who did get some legislation passed in the House, not in the Senate, but, you know, and did all the things that a congressman is supposed to do while he was here, you know, that it's wrong for establishment Republicans back in Metro Detroit to suddenly decide, you're not our guy, we're running somebody against you. Now, of course, they have every right to do that, but he feels betrayed by it and is, I think, is not a little hurt by the idea that they've gone after him in this way.
He's fine if the Democratic nominee winds up going to Washington.
Yeah, this is an interesting part of Congressman Benevolio's sort of thoughts about this. His argument is that even if McKenzie wins and the Democrat goes to represent what's clearly a Republican district, he'll only be there for 2 years because he'll be a Democrat in a majority Republican House, which everybody expects it to be. He'll be ineffective, and therefore somebody can come back in 2 years and take back the district. It's not the sort of thing you usually hear a Republican saying, but Congressman Benevolio is not your run-of-the-mill Republican.
I'm speaking with Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler as we look at the Michigan's 11th congressional district race. And as you mentioned, Todd, aggressive campaign definitely happening. Some of the ads in this race are really, really ugly. The ads kind of painting Dave Trot like Mr. Potter in It's a Wonderful Life. Let's take a listen to the ad we're talking about.
I'm Bobby McKenzie, and I approve this message because I'm fighting for Michigan families and not foreclosing on them.
Foreclosure King Dave Trot has made millions foreclosing on Michigan's families. Trot profited from human misery as tens of thousands of Michiganders were evicted from their homes. People like 101-year-old Mrs. Hollis, thrown out of her home of 50 years and left on the street. Foreclosure King Trot, he's caused too much misery to represent us in Congress.
Well, what does it tell you about the race, that kind of ad?
Well, we knew this was coming. I mean, the Democrats and Benevolio before that, I've always figured that Trot should have a hard time winning because of his firm's past in the foreclosure business. And they've made a lot of money off of the foreclosure business, which, you know, until very recently was a very big business, unfortunately, in the state of Michigan. All along, both sides knew this was maybe the only real vulnerability that Mr. Trot had, and we're going to go after him about it. And they have. And it's fair ground. I mean, there's no question about the fact that, you know, his firm has done a lot of foreclosure business. The Free Press has reported extensively on this. Trot's argument is also a fair one. I mean, you know, his argument is that foreclosure is a last option, but that when people don't pay their bills, banks and financial institutions have a right to go after certain people. In the case of the ad, you know, it was the Department of, you know, Housing and Urban Development that held that note and asked for that foreclosure. It was a case where the woman's, you know, children, I don't think, were paying, you know, the mortgage that they were required to pay. There were circumstances like that, which, of course, don't get mentioned in political ads. And political ads are always, you know, streamlined with a lot of those kind of facts left out. But the fact that it's gotten this aggressive on the part of Mr. McKenzie is probably his last best shot of making some noise on Election Day.
Where do the polls show the race right now, Todd?
there has been very little polling in this race. Mm-hmm. I think I saw one poll which had Trot up by about 12 points. Off-year elections, off-presidential year elections, particularly when you get into congressional districts, are notoriously difficult to sort of figure out who's going to show up and how many people are going to show up. You know, in a race like this, you would expect the Republican nominee to be up, you know, anywhere from 4 to 8 to 10 points. In a case like this, given how much money during the primary Mr. Trot spent getting his name out there, it might be a little higher. It might be as high as 12. I think that Mr. McKenzie and Mr. Benevolio have a real steep climb to knock Trot off.
Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler. Thanks so much, Todd.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. With Halloween just a few short days away, it's a perfect time to seek out a story that truly sends that proverbial chill down your spine. Broken Monsters is by South African author Lauren Bukes. It's crime, it's horror, it's a thriller, it's fantasy, and it is set in the streets of Detroit. Lauren Bukes is with us now from her home in Cape Town, South Africa. Thanks for joining us, Lauren.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lauren, this is a big, big book with a big, big cast, and you grab us right from page one with a stunningly awful crime set in Detroit. You're from South Africa, and of all the cities in the world in which to set Broken Monsters, why is it in Detroit?
Because Detroit is, like my hometown, Johannesburg, a city which is much maligned, and people want to reduce it to easy cliches about, you know, as a symbol of everything which is wrong with America or everything which is wrong with Africa. And Detroit is much more than that. It's a fascinating, very vibrant, alive, troubled city, and I really wanted to kind of get to the heart of it. It's kind of secretly my way of writing about Johannesburg again, because I think we have so many issues in common.
Give me a sense of what we share.
Well, you know, in South Africa, we like to think that we do crime and corruption and segregation the best, but you guys do a pretty good job out there. but it's also, you know, the vibrancy and the life and the art. There's a sense of hustle in Detroit, and I don't mean that in any bad way. I mean, people do what they have to get by, and there is kind of a very entrepreneurial spirit and a can-do spirit, which I think Detroit and Johannesburg have in common, where people are friendly because they're living, you know, in a situation which isn't necessarily the greatest, you know, the greatest situation with crime and, you know, foreclosures and all kinds of other stuff. But there is, at the same time, an incredible vibrancy and an incredible attitude and energy to the cities.
You know, Lauren, it's especially intriguing to us in Michigan looking at your view not only of Detroit, but your story takes us up north as well. What did you do to get such an authentic view of a city and state that's like 20-hour flight from your home in South Africa?
Well, I did fly out. I read all the books, and I followed a lot of the Detroit blogs and websites. But I also did come out to the city on two different occasions, and I just talked to people. You know, I worked in a soup kitchen at NOAA for a day and spoke to people who came there to try and get the homeless perspective on the city. I hung out with artists. I had this great young photographer who was driving me around in a family funeral home van because that was a car he was able to borrow, and that was kind of the perspective I got on Detroit. And we went to all these great parties and Eastern markets, and we went to Hipster Beach and on Belle Isle and all kinds of interesting things. And I spoke to cops. I interviewed homicide detectives. I went into homicide with a box of donuts and walked them through my crime scenes and made them solve the crime. So it was really just talking to native Detroiters and really getting their perspective on the city.
Would you read us an excerpt from Broken Monsters? The excerpt I hope you'd read for us, is it's really right out of the gate of your book when you serve up that first murder and your lead character, a wonderful female detective, we're going to talk about her a little more, Gabriella, comes onto the scene. Could you read us the excerpt?
Absolutely. So this is from the first chapter, called Bambi. Detective, the uniform says, because she's just standing there, staring down at the kid in the deep shadow of the tunnel, her hands jammed in the pockets of her jacket. She left her damn gloves in the car, and her fingers are numb from the chill wind sneaking in off the river. Winter baring its teeth, even though it's only gone November. Are you? Yeah, okay. She cuts him off, reading the name on his badge. I'm thinking about the adhesive, Officer Jones. Because mere superglue wouldn't do it. Holding the pieces together while the body was moved? This is not where the kid died. There's not enough blood on the scene. And there's no sign of his missing half. Black, no surprise in the city. 10 years old, you guess. Maybe older if you factored in malnourishment and development issues. Say somewhere between 10 and 16. Naked. As much of him as there is to be naked. It's entirely possible the rest of him is wearing pants, with his wallet in the back pocket and a cell phone that won't have any minutes, but which will make calling his mama a hell of a lot easier, wherever the rest of him is. He's lying on his side, his legs pulled up, eyes closed, face serene. The recovery position. Only he's never going to recover, and those aren't his legs. Skinny as a beanpole, beautiful skin, even if it's gone yellow from blood loss. Pre-adolescent, she decides. No sign of acne. No scratches or bruises either, or any indication that he put up a fight or had anything bad happen to him at all. Above the waist. Below the waist is a different story. Oh, boy. That's a whole other section of the bookstore. There is a dark gash right above where his hips should be, where he has been somehow attached to the lower half of a deer, hooves and all. The white flick of the tail sticks up like a jaunty little flag. The brown fur is bristled with dried blood. The flesh appears melted together at the seam. Officer Jones is hanging back. The smell is terrible. Plus, there's the gamey reek of the deer's scent glands. She pities the ME having to open up this mess. Better than the paperwork, though, or dealing with the goddamn media. Or worse, the mayor's office. Here, she offers, fishing a small red tub of lip gloss out of her pocket. Something she bought at the drugstore on a whim to appease her daughter. A candy-flavored cosmetic. That's sure to bridge the gap between them. It's not menthol, she says, but it's something. Thanks, he says grateful, which marks him out as an FNG, freaking new guy. He dips his finger in and smears the greasy balm under his nose, cherry-flavored snot. With sparkles in it, Gabby notices for the first time, but does not point out. Small pleasures. Don't get any on the scene, she warns him. No, no, I won't. And don't even think about taking any pictures on your phone to show your buddies. She looks around at the tunnel, with the graffiti that grows on bare walls in the city like plaque, the weight of the pre-dawn darkness, the lack of traffic. We're going to contain this. They do not remotely contain it.
That's author Lauren Bukes reading an excerpt from her latest novel, Broken Monsters, a horror, crime, suspense, fantasy story set in Detroit. You have quite a fascinating collection of characters, Lauren. Tell us more about Detective Gabriella Versado.
She's Latino, and she's relatively attractive, which makes her, in department slang, she's not just a twofer, which is, you know, a person of color. And a woman. She's actually a threefer because she's got her attractiveness going for her as well, which means that a lot of the other detectives are quite jealous of the fact that she's landed what, you know, appears to be a very high-profile case, and they think it's because of those factors. So she has to deal with a lot of kind of sexism and racism within the department and trying to show that she actually, you know, has earned this, absolutely, you know, with 18 years in homicide. So what's interesting about Gabby is that she's a single mom, recently divorced, to a 15-year-old daughter. And it's her relationship with her daughter which really drives a lot of the story. And the fact that her daughter is kind of getting into a lot of trouble online, catfishing for pedophiles. And it's the mother-daughter tension relationship which drives a lot of the story.
In fact, I got to point out here that the New York Times review of your book really praised the way that you drew the relationship between Gabby and her daughter, Layla. They note the current tendency of authors to portray teens as basically bottomless reservoirs of meanness and their parents hapless idiots. Do you have a teen daughter to kind of get that essence of the mother-teen-daughter relationship?
I have a 6-year-old daughter, and I sometimes think that she's going out at 16.
Yeah, that happens. But you really do give Layla's agility on the internet an important. It really does turn the internet into a character of its own, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, and I think, especially after my last book, The Shining Girls, I cut it off in 1993 because it was about a time traveling serial killer, and I just didn't want my heroine to be able to use the internet to solve the crime. But I miss the internet because the internet is so much a part of where I live my life, and so many of us live our lives, or at least part of our lives. And I really wanted to kind of explore that. And it was interesting because I, you know, some of the people I interviewed were Detroit teenagers who are at a theater school, Mosaic, and they talked about how if all the world's a stage, social media is the stage, and the rest of our lives is spent preparing to put on a show for that stage. And it was a very interesting dynamic in how teenagers experience social media right now, and how, you know, we really are living in the age of the end of privacy, and we have to find a way to live with that.
Lauren, what draws you to horror, thriller, fantasy stories?
I don't know. I just have a dark and twisted mind. I think it's a good way of kind of exploring social issues. And actually much more horrible things than anything I could ever make up happen every day. You know, there are just horrifying crimes against everyone. Especially living in such a violent country as, in society like South Africa, where we really do have terrible crime. Our national soccer captain just got shot over his cell phone fatally 2 days ago. And it's just devastating. And it's too hard to write about that. And it's too awful to write about that. So I think horror it's like looking through a mirror or a glass darkly. It gives you one step removed, a way of looking at the issue in a way that makes it maybe more bearable, even while it makes it more horrible.
Well, as we look at Broken Monsters, what do you hope people take out of this book?
Well, I think I write books because I am asking myself questions that I don't necessarily know the answer to. So I want people to think about art and the internet and the monsters we are within. And the title, the title is thematic. We all have little broken parts in us. We all have had horrible life experiences somewhere along the way. And it's how we find a way to live with that that makes us who we are. But it's also the fact that there are no monsters, that even the monsters are broken. And I think I try to bring a lot of sympathy in for the killer. Who is just a symptom of broken masculinity and thwarted ambition. And I really wanted to play with that and to look at what we are capable of, the good and the evil.
Lauren Bukes, her latest novel is Broken Monsters, and Lauren spoke with us from her home in Cape Town, South Africa. Lauren, it was great to meet you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I feel like I'm kind of back in Michigan even a little bit.
Come back anytime.
Thank you.
As we get our bowls of candy ready and the kids decide on their costumes for Friday night's trick-or-treating, there are those in Michigan preparing for another holiday, Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos. This holiday has spread from Mexico throughout the world. It coincides with All Hallows' Eve, Halloween to most of us, All Saints' Day on November 1st, and All Souls' Day, November 2nd. Dia de los Muertos is the time to honor and pray for friends and loved ones who've passed away. Jose Lara is an assistant professor of Spanish at Grand Valley State University. So good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is a Mexican tradition that goes back very far, doesn't it?
Yes. Actually, it goes back to the pre-Columbian era. What Day of the Dead initially was a ritual, part of the Mexica tradition, where they honored those who have passed away.
And give us the sense of what this holiday is meant to do.
Well, one of the things that this holiday is tied to is commemorating those who have passed away. As you mentioned, it's a time to remember not only the fact that they have passed away, but also to celebrate life. As you know, death and life are really tied together. So in a sense, it's part of the cycle of life that we're really going back to. What we have is a mixture. You mentioned All Saints Days, All Souls Days. And so what happens is a syncretic tradition was developed where we have pre-Columbian or indigenous, as you might want to call it, tradition combining with European tradition.
How is it celebrated, particularly in the U.S.?
Well, in the U.S., we have a couple of things. The Day of the Dead usually is a time where you go to the cemeteries, the burial where those have passed away. Now, given the fact that there's a large Latino population and some of those who have passed away are not in the U.S. or Mexico, so that's not possible. What we have is the construction of altars, whether it's in open spaces or even in the home. And so that altar, in a sense, takes that place of the cemetery. Because usually what we have is communities come together and they take flowers, the favorite dishes of those who passed away, also photographs, in this case, especially in the U.S., where everyone is pretty much can bring in a photograph of their loved ones and
place on the altar. So in a sense, you're recreating that tradition.
And even those with, I think, the most casual awareness of the Day of the Dead are aware that skulls play a part. Explain that to us.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the most basic thing is obviously death is associated with skulls. And so in Mexico, we have a representation of La Catrina, which is the Lady of Death. So that's where also you get the skull, but this is a female skull. And so you see that in addition to sometimes some of the sugar skull, it's actually it's a skull, it's a colorful skull made of sugar, and it can actually be consumed. So that's also given to children. So you have that reverence to death, but also that humor, in a sense, where you're also celebrating life. I think one of the things that sometimes we think is we're only celebrating those who passed away, but we're also celebrating those who are still present. And so that is that relationship, that continuous relationship between life and death.
And, Jose, there is a workshop at GVSU happening this Thursday. What's going on and who's taking part of in it?
Oh, absolutely. This is really become part of the tradition at GVSU, the Latin American Studies program. It's part of area studies under the Brooks College of Interdisciplinary Studies. So the last few years, we have developed a workshop where we bring in a local artist, Orlando Mancera, who's Mexican and whose passion really is Mexican and Latino identity. And what we've decided to do is actually have Orlando Mancera come in and explain the symbols, the different symbols, the tradition itself, the history from pre-Columbian to the present, and more importantly, allow for students and community members to partake in the construction of the altar. So they're, and this is open to everyone. Obviously, you think of Day of the Dead celebration with Latinos, but this is also part of really an integrative learning experience where everyone is invited. So it sort of brings everyone together to celebrate this cultural event too.
And really, isn't it true that if you look at cultures around the world, Jose, there are versions of this kind of celebration in many cultures because we do want to honor those who have gone before us?
Absolutely. I mean, and we're talking about not just European Western cultures. You're thinking of Asian cultures. I think this is something universal, you know, the honoring the dead and really celebrating life as well.
Jose Lara is an assistant professor of Spanish at Grand Valley State University, and he's a member of the Latin American Studies program. They will be holding their workshop at Grand Valley State University this Thursday, and there are events happening throughout Southeast Michigan for Day of the Dead. For instance, the Detroit Institute of Arts will have an exhibit of altars made by local artists. It's open to the public, and it runs until November 2nd. Jose, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The restaurant industry is becoming more and more important to Michigan. In fact, the restaurant industry is one of the largest and fastest growing industries in Metro Detroit. But many entry-level workers have trouble becoming managers. They find it difficult to move up to a better position, and some say this difficulty stems from racial and gender discrimination. Stateside's Renee Gross reports.
When I visited David Hardiman at the cafe where he works in Detroit, things were going a bit slow.
I love tomatoes, getting them ready for the next go at it.
And for Hardiman, slow days are the worst.
I don't ever stop moving. I'm hyper. I like to move around, busybody. It's like work to me to work slow.
And that energy is really helpful for working at restaurants.
My employer, they didn't know about some stuff. They look around and they just see stuff done. And it's like, when did you do that? When did you stock that? I stocked that in between when I was cleaning.
Hardiman has been praised a lot for his good work. But promotions are a whole other story. Hardiman is 35 years old and has been working off and on in casual dining since high school. He says he's gone after a general manager position but didn't get it. And a lot of other African Americans find themselves in that same position.
There's racial and gender discrimination and segregation related to this kind of lack of mobility and really glass ceilings faced by these workers.
That's Saro J.U. Rahman. She's the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley.
The vast majority of workers of color are concentrated in lower-level segments, meaning fast food and casual as opposed to fine dining, and lower-level positions like dishwasher versus server in a fine dining restaurant.
J.U. Rahman says part of the problem is that usually workers are not promoted from within the restaurant.
But instead, outside hiring happens, and that's when often white workers have the advantage.
But not everybody sees mobility as a problem in restaurants.
So I think we do a very good job as an industry in allowing people to move up.
That's Brian DeBano. He's the CEO of the Michigan Restaurant Association. He says minorities are doing really well in the restaurant field.
Minorities own about 33% of restaurants compared to only about 21% of other businesses. And about one in three restaurant managers are minorities.
And he says to make a good business, you can only have so many managers.
They need to do a good job with their business model of managing the number of managerial and salaried employees they have versus entry level, if you will, or part-time employees.
Good afternoon, sir.
Back at the cafe, it's clear that Hardiman does not want to stay in this position forever. Someday he wants to own his own restaurant. That way he'll be able to provide for his wife and their newborn son. And he'll be able to do what he loves, bringing people together over food.
They come to eat, everybody wants to have a good time. I never seen anyone eating and being mad.
Good service and good food may do the trick to making customers happy. But to make everybody who works in the restaurant industry happy, well, it seems that that answer is a lot more complicated. For Stateside, I'm Renee Gross.
Last December, the GOP brought in Senator Rand Paul to christen its new voter engagement office in Detroit. Bridge Magazine writer Nancy Derringer recently visited the office. She wanted to check up on how things are going. Hello, Nancy.
Hello, Cynthia. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. And Aaron Foley is with us. He's a Detroit-based freelance writer. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, Cynthia. How are you?
Good. Nancy, I want to start with you. You phrase it very succinctly in your piece for Bridge Magazine, and I'll quote, "Election after election, Republican candidates are squashed like bugs in Detroit." Any chance this GOP office in Detroit might make a dent in that narrative for this election?
I guess it depends on what you consider a dent. Even they admit that they would be thrilled if they could bump the percentage by maybe a point or two. They fully admit that this is a long-term effort. It probably will never be a Republican city. The best they can hope for is to have a few more Republican votes than they had the last time. However, they claim that they're very sincere. They say the office is going to stay open after the election. And I think that's when we'll find out what their commitment really is.
You profile Wayne Bradley, who works out of that office. Is he basically the only person working out of the office?
It's hard to say. I mean, because this is also an office that is a standard campaign office. You know, you can see Rick Snyder signs, Terry Lynn Land signs. So there's a lot of just general election work that's being done out of that office. The most I probably saw there were maybe half a dozen people, and almost all of them were volunteers. So I think Wayne is the only person who is paid to do this work here.
And we should point out that Wayne Bradley is the state director of African American Engagement. Aaron Foley, you live and work in Detroit. Do you think there's any more awareness of the GOP's message in Detroit neighborhoods because of this office?
There's two ways of looking at it. I don't think many people in Detroit know the office exists, and I don't think many people are quite yet aware of Bradley going door to door and whatnot. But it is interesting, as you pointed out in the piece in Bridge, that so many Republican ideals and so many things that the party is built on line up with what's going on in the church, and so many ideals rooted in religion. And here in Detroit, the black church is so strong, you literally cannot get elected to office in this region without going to all of the big churches and speaking in front of the congregation and whatnot, because you know, you have to talk to the pastors, you have to talk to the preachers, and you have to talk to all these people who go to church. And it's interesting that those two worlds haven't aligned in Detroit. A lot of people still vote Democrat, even though, you know, where they worship and where a lot of their faith is, that's more of a Republican thing. And Bradley's work is admirable, but I think people just see the word Republican and are just turned off by it immediately.
Nancy, what is the message that Wayne Bradley and his volunteers are pushing, do you think?
I think it's a two-part message. The first is about Detroit and what has happened in the city and for the city under the administration of Governor Rick Snyder. You know, they're pointing at the bankruptcy proceedings, at the emergency manager, at the grand bargain, at the swift procession of the bankruptcy case, and they're saying, look, you know, if you're honest with yourself, you cannot deny that there is a brighter future for the city ahead and that it is the result of a Republican legislature, which pledged a lot of money to the grand bargain, to a governor who had the guts to just pull the trigger on the bankruptcy, to Kevin Orr, et cetera. That's the first part. The second part is what Aaron alluded to just a few minutes ago, which is that, you know, if you sit down and look at what you want, what your life is about, you have to admit that we have a lot in common. You know, you're for faith and family, we're for faith and family. You want good schools, we want good schools. You know, you want to feel safe in your home and, you know, you want crime to go down, that's what we're all about. So what they're saying is, you know, forget what you grew up doing, forget what your parents did or what your minister might have told you. If you really sit down and think about this clear-headedly, we're your people. And, you know, how successful that will be, well, that's the time will tell kind of thing.
I'm talking with Bridge magazine writer Nancy Derringer, whose piece in Bridge, GOP Hunts Votes in the D, looking at the ways the Republicans are trying to win over a few more votes in Democratic Detroit. And I'm also talking with Detroit-based freelance writer Aaron Foley. Aaron, I'm wondering, which do you think speaks louder to voters in Detroit? Governor Snyder appointing an emergency manager and basically taking away the keys to the car from city council and Detroit's mayor, or what he did in Lansing to get the grand bargain through the legislature?
I think the former that you talked about as far as appointing an emergency manager in Detroit, because it's a historical thing. Black people in not just Detroit, but the country, you know, things like the right to vote, the things that, you know, are the people who came before us have fought so hard for, to essentially sort of take that away, I think is still rubbing people the wrong way, taking away, you know, that democratic process and whatnot. So I think there's still going to be some hurdles for the party to get over when it comes to trying to get people on their side, because they're going to have that fresh in their mind.
You know, we know that GOP got a real clear message in the 2012 elections that it is dealing with a demographic ticking time bomb, as you put in your piece, Nancy. You know, we saw 1980 with an electorate that was 88% white, and in 2012, it was 72% white. Do you think this voter engagement office, this approach, is the right way to reach out to non-white voters? Or is it easy to see this as political theater or as window dressing? What do you think, Nancy?
I think a case can be made for either answer there. I think that they're right that this has to happen at the grassroots level. You know, they were very guarded about letting me kind of, you know, hang around the office, hang out with Wayne and kind of just see how this is working. So it's very hard for me to say whether this is a strategy that's going to work for them. But they also have a problem at the national level. And we've seen it most obviously under the current presidency, particularly in the early years. It seemed like a month did not go by that you didn't hear some county GOP chairman was like busted sending out some racist cartoon that featured the president, you know, growing watermelons on the White House lawn or something like that. And it was always like, and there would always be apologies, and Republicans would say, this is not who we are. But at some point, you know, you have to hear the Republicans who have high national profiles stating in no uncertain terms and getting angry if they need to be that this stuff is simply not acceptable anymore. Even among your friends, even if you think this is funny and you're sending it to like half a dozen people that who are going to find it funny too, you just can't do this anymore. It's just wrong.
It has to be challenging, Aaron Foley, isn't it, to be a black Republican to Detroit trying to sell people on the merits of a party where a pretty vocal crowd have been pushing the idea Barack Obama's birth certificate is fake?
You know, I think there is a bigger racial issue, especially here in Michigan, that we haven't talked about, because so many Republicans who have been voted to state office and county office and whatnot are Republican, and they rub a lot of black people the wrong way. You know, we had so many years under Engler, and a lot of people in Detroit, if you say the name John Engler, everyone will think of the mental hospital and some of the services that were closed that put a lot of people out on the street. And look at the effect that had on Detroit. If you say Republican to a black person in Oakland County, for example, you might think of L. Brooks Patterson, who is very, very, you know, we can talk all day about some of the controversial things he said about Detroit over the years. There's a definite image problem because so many Republicans are white, and a lot of black people, you know, we just in general tend to, you know, not only do we vote for people that sort of align with our ideals, but, you know, sometimes it's an issue of voting for people that you look like. If you have an entire party that's basically composed of, let's say, like 40 to 50 year old white males, and you don't see a lot of diversity in there, what's the incentive for me or someone like me to say, like, okay, what are you offering me? You know, what perspectives do you have that can benefit me as well? I'm sort of reminded of this time when I was in college. I was recruited by a white fraternity that had a mostly white fraternity. I shouldn't say a white fraternity, but a mostly white fraternity who had all these issues on campus. They were barred from doing activity with the Greek Council and whatnot. And they were trying to rebuild their image. And one of the things they were doing was trying to recruit a lot more minority students. But myself and a couple others, you know, we just sort of looked at it like, but, you know, you're doing all these things still that don't really mesh with what we've historically done. So, you know, what's the incentive for us to join? And I think that's what the Republican Party is going through. They're trying to get a lot of minorities in there just to say, like, hey, you know, we've got diversity, but, you know, at the same time, there's sort of that missing link there.
Right back to the window dressing, to that image of window dressing.
Was it the governor of Pennsylvania? Just last week, they discovered that there's a picture of him on his website surrounded by an ethnically diverse crowd of admirers who are all looking at him. And somebody said, you know, the black woman was photoshopped in from a stock photo. I mean, it's almost ludicrous. You have to go to these lengths in order to look like you have diversity in your party. It just seems insane. And, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for Wayne because I think he's very sincere. You know, he's like, this could work. We have to make it work. But it seems as though his own team is working against him at some level.
And as the state director of African American Engagement, you show us in your piece how Wayne Bradley is, you know, knocking on doors and going to barbershops and, you know, being part of the neighborhood as best he can. What's the reception like as he comes in and talks to people? How would you?
Well, it's interesting. The one event that I went to with him was the barbershop. And, you know, this is a barbershop where Wayne says he has literally been getting his hair cut there all his life. He grew up in this neighborhood. He doesn't live there anymore, but, you know, just a couple blocks away, he still goes there. And, you know, the guys they're friendly. You know, hey, Wayne, how you doing? I mean, nobody was rude to him. At the same time, you know, he's kind of pressing this campaign literature on people, and I didn't see anybody really responding enthusiastically. You know, he's a really upbeat guy. He's a natural salesman, you know, and he just says, well, you just got to plant these seeds. And so, you know, I guess he's still in the plowing and planting stage at this point. And how many are actually going to find fertile ground? I guess that's one of those remains to be seen things.
Yeah, I noted how you described how he's received politely, which to me seems rather damned with a faint praise, I guess.
Well, you know, I mean, nobody's throwing, you know, throwing barbershop clippers at him and telling him to get out the door. But I mean, you know, and they're nice to him. I mean, these are guys that he's known for a long time. But, you know, he hands him a pamphlet that says 470,000 Michiganders have health care now. You know, he's talking about the Medicaid expansion and the Detroit progress and so forth. But they did not look like they were ready to walk into the voting booth and vote a straight GOP ticket.
Aaron, what do you think ultimately can come from these kinds of efforts? Looking ahead into the future, I know I'm asking you to look into a crystal ball, but what are your thoughts?
First of all, I think a barbershop, if you can't win any friends in a barbershop, then you might have a lost cause because, you know, a barbershop is sacred ground, it's community ground in the black community. And if you can't win them there, then it's going to be a much harder uphill climb than anyone ever expected. But what I have noticed is that a lot of younger African-Americans are sort of, I know Nancy mentioned that, you know, people tend to do what they've historically done because their parents and their grandparents have done it. But I do notice that a lot of younger African Americans do think differently about lots of things. Think differently about their role in government. Think differently about their government's role in their lives. And they do explore different political parties, different religions, different ways of thinking. So you might see a slight, very slight uptick of people who maybe not full on join the Republican Party, but maybe, you know, think about it a little bit. Once you get people to think about it, then that's when you start selling the idea. I think it's sort of too much too soon to just push the ideas and say, hey, join the party. But I think getting people to think about it, open your mind a little bit, then, you know, the conversation can go a little bit further.
Those seeds that Wayne Bradley is so patiently and pleasantly trying to sow. Nancy Derringer's piece, GOP Hunts Votes in the D, can be found in Bridge Magazine. Just go to bridgemi.com. And Aaron Foley is a Detroit-based freelance writer. Aaron, Nancy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It was great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.